scriptures of the Old Testament in the book of Exodus, which we are currently studying. We've come this morning to the 23rd chapter, and we read together from the first verse. Exodus chapter 23 and verse 1. You shall not utter a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness in court. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a suit, turning aside after a multitude so as to pervert justice. Nor shall you be partial towards a poor man in his suit. If you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the ass of one who hates you lying under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall help him to lift it up. You shall not pervert the justice due to your poor in his suit. Keep far from a false charge, and do not slay the innocent and the righteous, for I will not acquit the wicked, and you shall take no bribe. For a bribe blinds the officials and subverts the cause of those who are in the right. You shall not oppress a stranger, for you know the heart of a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. For 6 years, you shall sow your land and gather in its yield. But the 7th year you shall let it rest and lie fallow, that the poor of your people may eat, and what they leave the wild beasts may eat. You shall do likewise with your vineyard and with your olive orchard. 6 days you shall do your work, but on the 7th day you shall rest, that your ox and your ass may have rest, and the son of your bondmaid and the alien may be refreshed. Take heed to all that I have said to you, and make no mention of the names of other gods, nor let such be heard out of your mouth. Amen, and the Lord will add his blessing to the reading from his word. To his name be the honor and the praise. Now you may recall that the broad general theme of Exodus chapter 22, the previous chapter to the one we read this morning, is the theme of restoration and of restitution. And in the first half of that previous chapter, the subject is the restitution of things, of goods that have been stolen. These have to be handed back. A compensation has to be made for property damaged in a fire. Justice has to be dispensed to the innocent victims of crime, as well as to the guilty criminals of crime. Justice for the innocent as well as for the guilty. The restoration of goods and property and of things. In the second half of that previous chapter, 22, this approach is continued again with the restoration and the restitution of people. People who have been the victims of wickedness have to be lifted up and restored. The virgin who has been violated, the stranger who has been abused and humiliated, the man who has become a pauper and is forced to beg for his living, the man who is in such reduced circumstances that he has pawned his clothes in order to stay alive, all of these have been degraded and humbled by circumstance, and they need to be lifted up and restored to what God intended them to be, men and women made in the image of God with dignity and with honor, men and women who are able to walk upright and not be ashamed. The restoration of people. And that theme of restoration is continued into the chapter we read this morning. The first half of chapter 23 of Exodus is about the restoration of society. And what you have here are the broad moral and ethical principles that should underline and undergird every healthy and happy and right society. Society, man's social life, what the wedding service calls our common life together, is to be lifted up and restored to what God intended our common life to be. The restoration of society. Now, it's an observable fact that Christians, on the whole, have tended to shy away from this approach to the world and its problems, especially in the evangelical wing of the church. Christians have tended to steer clear of social issues and have confined themselves to the narrow world of the church, the world of salvation and piety and prayer and personal redemption. Christians have tended to live in that little circle, and they've tended to avoid getting involved with social issues. And they've done this particularly in the past 100 years for two reasons. In the first place, many Christians argue that there is no such thing as a Christian society. Not only does the Bible not speak of Christian societies, the Bible does not even visualize a Christianization of the world. The gospel, says the Bible, is not going to be universally accepted by all men, and even Jesus himself did not visualize a Christianization of the world. In fact, Jesus gave us all a rather dark future. He spoke about wars and rumors of war, earthquakes in various places, brother betraying brother, father betraying children, children betraying their parents, and a man's foes shall be from his own household. Now, that is Christ's view of the future. It is a dark and a somber view. And so Christians in the past 100 years have tended to eschew and to avoid social and political issues. And many Christians have even negated or denied involvement with the dirty world at all. I know Christians who refuse to vote on the grounds that politics is a dirty business and Christians shouldn't dirty their fingers by getting involved in politics. I know Christians who on principle will not join a trade union. I know Christians who will not enter the armed forces or stand for a local council. World denial and world negation on the grounds that man is a sinner, he is a creature gone wrong, and all efforts by him to construct a Christian society will end up like himself, flawed. And so the best that can be done is rescue work, saving the twos and the threes, picking out a remnant. Now, there's a great deal of truth in all that. Some Christians have been arguing like that for around 100 years. Man is a flawed creature, and any society he makes will be a flawed society. The idea of a Christian society is never mentioned in the Bible, and the Bible certainly does not hold out to us the idea of a Christian world permeated by the sweetness and the light of the gospel. And it is undeniable that much Christian work today is rescue work, saving men and women from destruction, what Amos calls brands plucked from the burning. But Jesus did say, "You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father who is in heaven." Christians are to be the salt of society, to preserve it from corruption. Active salt. Social and political salt. Left-wing salt, if that's the way you are, or right-wing salt, if that's the way you are, or middle-of-the-road salt, if that's the way you are, or SDP salt, if that's the way you are. Jesus said, "You are the salt to save the fabric of society from putrefaction and from decay." And secondly, Christians in the past 100 years have tended to avoid the social approach to the problems because of what is sometimes called the social gospel. The social gospel was something that you might have heard in the churches, or maybe towards the end of last century, although the influence of the social gospel is still found in the churches today. It was preached by late Victorians who came to the Bible with what is sometimes scathingly called the scissors and paste method. That's to say, they cut out of the Bible what they didn't like, scissors, and they stuck into the Bible what they thought should be there, paste. Scissors and paste. You remove what you don't like, and you stick in what you think should be there. And of course, the supernatural was removed. They cut out miracles, the resurrection, and many of them even cut out life after death. And instead, for the social gospelers, true religion became an activist affair, concerned for the poor, working in the slums, working for better working conditions. The social gospel said that if you were involved, it didn't matter what you believed, you were a Christian. Social gospel. And so living Christians withdrew from that social gospel because they knew perfectly well that that is not the gospel of Christ at all. And so living Christians washed their hands of involvement in the major issues of the world and its needs. And that is more or less where we stand today. On the whole, very few Christians are involved in the great moral and international issues of our day. The whole business of war and the bomb, chemical warfare, bacteriological warfare, abortion, unemployment, euthanasia, housing conditions, the problems of the homeless single, problems of drug abuse. If you look at the processions marching through the streets, campaigning for the big issues today, on the whole, Christians as Christians are missing. And instead you see left-wing groups, Marxist groups, red banners, Trotskyite students, and the humanists campaigning for a just society. They campaign for a just society because the Christians have washed their hands of these issues. If you were to go back a century into our history, you would find a very different scene. The people who campaigned then were committed Christians. James Keir Hardie, one of the founders of the labor movement, the Earl of Shaftesbury, who worked for children, Gladstone, who worked for the abolition of prostitution in Victorian England, Thomas Grenfell, his medical work, Thomas Barnardo, his work amongst children, William Quarrier and his homes. These were all men who were 100% for Jesus Christ. And their social care and their compassion came out of their faith in Christ. I think that perhaps the only man, a prominent man in our generation, who is campaigning for this now is Sir Frederick Catherwood. And he has a splendid book called A Better Way. Fred Catherwood, who is married to the daughter of the late Martin Lloyd-Jones. And it's interesting that the subtitle of his book, A Better Way, is The Case for a Christian Social Order. We have to bring our Christian values into our approach to the world and its problems. Well, here in Exodus chapter 23, you have the rudiments and the bare outlines of what a just Christian society should be like. There are four elements, we'll cover them very briefly, four elements, and the important thing to notice is this, that without these four elements in a society, no one is safe. I'll say that again. Without these four elements in society, no one is safe. And the first element is truth. You shall not utter a false report. You shall not join hands with a wicked man to be a malicious witness. You shall not follow a multitude to do evil, nor shall you bear witness in a suit, turning aside after a multitude so as to pervert justice. A society must have truth, because without truth, no one is safe. Not even the rulers in society are safe without truth. Because if a society is run on lies, on corruption, on sycophancy, on partiality, on a system of secret police and informers and people who can be bribed to blind their eyes. It is the witness of history that that society dies, and it becomes the victim of its own corruption. And the rulers who engineered the lies also fall prey to their own schemes. My friends, Trotsky was killed with an ice pick through his skull, and the man who put it there was a fellow communist. Beria, the master strategist of Stalin's secret police, who was responsible for the death of hundreds of thousands of innocent people in Russia in the 1930s, Beria was executed by Stalin. A few years ago, we used to speak about B&K in the Soviet Union. Bulganin and Khrushchev. Then Bulganin vanished. And then Khrushchev vanished. And so did Molotov and the 12 million other Russians who manufactured the lies and the corruption of post-revolutionary Russia. Without truth, no man is safe. John Huss, the great Czech reformer who was martyred 100 years before our Reformation, in his booklet, The Exposition of the Faith, John Huss said, "Therefore, O faithful Christian, search for truth, hear truth, learn truth, love truth, hold the truth, and defend the truth till death, for without it, no one is safe." The second element is the element of love, and especially love for your enemy in verses 4 and 5. If you meet your enemy's ox or his ass going astray, you shall bring it back to him. If you see the ass of someone who hates you lying under its burden, you shall refrain from leaving him with it. You shall help this man who hates you to lift it up. Of course, it's easy to love the people you like, isn't it? It's easy to love the people who share your point of view and who belong to your club and whose tastes and views are your tastes and views. It's easy to love someone you like. But how hard a thing it is to love the people you don't like, the people you can't stand, and whose mannerisms drive you mad. The people who aren't in your club or coterie and who don't share your outlook. And yet, without love for your enemy, no one is safe. For if you hate your enemy will hate you, and the two of you together will simply perpetuate the malice and the ill will and the venom of a poisoned society. King Solomon once said, "Rejoice not when your enemy stumbles." Well, why should you not rejoice when your enemy stumbles? Because one day you will stumble. And who's going to lift you up? "Do good to those who hate you," said Jesus, "and pray for those who despitefully use you. For by so doing, you will heap coals of fire on their heads." Love for your enemy. Without it, no one is safe. Thirdly, compassion for the stranger. Verse 9. You shall not oppress a stranger. You know the heart of a stranger, for you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Compassion for the stranger. Now, I suppose you hardly need me to tell you that the word compassion means suffering with, suffering alongside, standing in the sufferer's shoes, and identifying yourself with the sufferer in his suffering. That's compassion, not here's a bunch of flowers, goodbye, or here's a check, goodbye. That's not compassion. Compassion is, here am I. Let me stand in your shoes. Let me be one with you where you stand. Compassion. And without that in society, no one is safe. I wonder if you know the original meaning of the word Hebrew. Our word Hebrew comes from a word chabiru, and it literally means the man from the other side of the river. That's chabiru, or the other side of the street. Foreigners, outcasts. I suppose the most contemporary translation would be immigrants, just as the Jews had been immigrants in Babylon and Persia and Rome and in all the nations since the death of Jesus. We are to love the immigrants. We are to have compassion on the strangers. And surely Christians should find that easy, because the New Testament calls Christians strangers and pilgrims. We too are immigrants. We are foreigners in a strange land. Surely we should have compassion on strangers. Without that, no one is safe. And lastly, respect for creation. In verse 10, the practice of working the land for 6 years and then letting it lie fallow for the seventh. 20th century man has yet to learn the lesson of respecting God's creation. We have raped creation. We have violated it and abused it and ruined it. And the garden of God in many places has become a nightmare. The Mediterranean in some places is just a sewer. Half the filth of Europe is poured into the River Danube, so that by the time it has reached the sea, having passed through Vienna, Bratislava, and Budapest, the River Danube is far from blue. Fish have not been seen in the River Mersey for 80 years. 3 years ago, scientists were astonished to find a salmon at London Bridge. A fish had not been seen at London Bridge for 80 years. Admittedly, it was a dead salmon. 200 years ago, you could fish for salmon in the Thames at London. Take a boat from Westminster Quay today and go down to Greenwich and see the debris in the River Thames. Man has raped creation, abused it, ruined it. And respect for God's creation, for its fields and its gardens, for its mineral resources, is part of a just Christian society. Here then is the Bible's dream. Truth. Without it, no one is safe. Love for your enemy. Care and compassion for the immigrant. And respect for God's creation. That's the Bible's dream. Let's see if we can make it a reality. Amen. May the Lord add a blessing to the preaching of his word. To his name be the praise and the glory. Now the baptismal hymn is number 309, by Cool Siloam's Shady Rill, How Sweet the Lily Grows.